Our scripture reading for today is Matthew 27, 45 through 56. From noon until 3 in the afternoon, darkness came over all the land. About 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar and put it on a staff and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook. The rocks split and the tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." Many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. This is the word of the Lord, and together we say, thanks be to God.
Thanks, Les. Today, as Chris mentioned, today is Palm Sunday. And traditionally on the Christian church calendar, the Sunday before Easter Sunday is considered Palm Sunday because it begins, again, as Chris mentioned, it begins Holy Week, which is just the term that Christians for 2,000 years have used to remember the story of Jesus entering the city of Jerusalem. And about a month ago, because of where we're at in the Gospel of Matthew, if you're new to us, we've been journeying through Matthew's biography of Jesus for 2.5 years. And it ends next Sunday, on Easter Sunday, our 2.5 year journey. So because of our pacing, a month ago, we explored the Palm Sunday story. And if you were here, you might recall me saying that if you really look at Palm Sunday on the surface, all these people celebrating and welcoming Jesus as this like triumphant king, on the surface, it's kind of a joke because we know where the Palm Sunday story will end. The Palm Sunday story will end at the story we are in today. This king who enters the city will eventually die the death of a criminal on a cross. He will literally be exposed as, at least in the eyes of the world at the time, a total scam. This isn't a king. He's a criminal worth killing on a cross. But as many of us know, that's also not the end of the story. But before we arrive at the actual end of the story next Sunday, we want to sit for a moment today at this point in the story. And today will lead us again, as Kayvon said, to Friday. And hopefully many of you will join us for Good Friday. The death of Jesus, the king who came to rescue us and change the human story forever, does so by dying. This brutal, dark death on a criminal's cross. I want to show you a painting here. This is a painting by a 17th century Spanish artist named Francisco de Zurbarán, and the painting is called, fittingly, The Crucifixion. Has anybody ever been to the Art Institute in Chicago? Anyone? One of my favorite museums on the planet. It's incredible. If you've never been, next time you're in Chicago, the Art Institute of Chicago. It's right there downtown next to the Bean. It's worth your time. Now, The Crucifixion by de Zurbarán is at the Art Institute of Chicago. And I did not know what about this painting the first time I visited the museum, but I remember being absolutely arrested the moment I saw it. Because you can't tell in the image I'm showing you, but this painting is almost 6 feet wide and almost 10 feet tall. And it's hung near the entrance, at least the first time I saw it, it was hung near the entrance of the museum. So you're walking in to this epic museum, and then immediately one of the first things you encounter is essentially the darkness of Good Friday looming large over you. And I remember the first time I saw this piece, I was captivated by what you are all noticing probably in some ways right now. How alone Jesus is. De Zurbaran was very intentional in the way he painted this piece. This is not how the scene of Jesus's crucifixion would have actually looked. As you read the story, what you know is that when Jesus was crucified, there were lots of other people around him. There were criminals to his left and to his right. There were Roman soldiers. There were some of his followers trembling in fear and in grief. He was surrounded by people, but the painting depicts not the actual historical scene. To me, the power of this piece is that it so beautifully and poignantly and accurately depicts the emotional, mental, and spiritual state that Jesus must have been in at his crucifixion. Jesus was completely isolated and alone on the cross. I mean, think about it. Jesus had never known separation from God, his Father. Now, for those of us who've been Christians for a while, you are familiar with the theology of the Trinity. It's an orthodoxy that we hold dear here at Westgate. We believe that God, there is one true God of the universe, but that this one God exists as a perpetual relationship. Three in one, God the Father, Jesus the Son, and the Holy Spirit, that this relationship makes up the one true God of the universe. So there is God the Father, and then there is Jesus the Son, and they are one in ways that you and I, with our feeble, frail human minds, cannot actually comprehend. But the scriptures make clear they are one. But what is happening in this scene? God the Father and Jesus the Son are being torn apart. Again, Jesus has never been this isolated and alone before. This is unfamiliar territory to him. Jesus experiences a depth of loneliness that you and I could not possibly know. It is a separation from himself. It is a tearing apart of his eternal identity. And so what does he do? He cries out, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, for those of us who are good Christians, we want to neutralize the gravity of Jesus' words here. Like, he doesn't really mean that God has forsaken him, right? He's just kind of being dramatic or hyperbolic, or it must mean something else. We try to do like theological jujitsu, you know, to try to explain it away. But most scholars would tell you, no, we have to take Jesus' words here, his declaration of abandonment, or at least a feeling of abandonment, at face value. One theologian puts it this way, that in giving his life, Jesus, giving his life as a ransom for many for the forgiveness of sins, Jesus must, for the moment, be separated from his Father. This is, again, why the Zurbaran painting is so powerful. Jesus is truly alone here in a way that no human ever has been. Again, a tearing apart of his eternal identity. Now, I share this with you because I want to ask you a question. Have you ever felt alone? Like, even surrounded by people, have you ever had that emotional, mental, relational experience of visually seeing a bustling, hustling world all around you, but feeling like the painting as if everything is going black and you are in a tiny, suffocating box of your own isolation? Have you ever felt abandoned? Think about the people that you thought were supposed to love you most. Those who you assumed had your best interests in mind. Those who you just assumed, man, they are totally, completely, utterly committed to me. And then there is some act of betrayal or pain or separation, and you feel, again, alone and isolated. Do you know what that feels like? I don't know all of your stories in great detail. I know some. But my assumption is that in a room this size, there are many stories of abandonment, many stories of relationships and safety sort of blacking out, and you finding yourself isolated and alone. What this story today tells us, if nothing else, is that Jesus understands. Maybe you feel abandoned and alone today. Maybe you carry with you into this room full of lots of happy, shiny, smiling people, and you're like just putting on the face. But really, if we were to take our masks off, what you would discover is that there are many in this room just like you, isolated and alone. And for all of us, Jesus understands. He knows what it's like to feel alone, abandoned, ostracized, and forgotten. But that phrase that he utters, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you left me alone? Why have you abandoned, ostracized, forgotten me? When he utters those words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Those words are not words he whipped up out of thin air. Jesus is actually verbatim quoting a psalm. Some of us know this. He is quoting specifically Psalm 22, which begins this way. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, but I find no rest. I mean, these words resonate. These words were written thousands of years ago, but they resonate, don't they? Like, these are words that I have felt in my life. God, why have you forsaken me? Why don't you answer me? I need you. Where are you? Do you care? Do you love me? Are you real? Do you actually have the power to enact change? Do you care enough to enact change? Do you not feel what I feel? Do you not understand my pain, my loneliness, my abandonment, my isolation? Have you forgotten me? Have you forsaken me? Jesus on the cross, in his moment of absolute abandonment, he utters the words written by the psalmist in Psalm 22. You know, what's really fascinating about Psalm 22. If you read the entire psalm, you realize Jesus is brilliant. The entire psalm is actually a foreshadowing of the experience he is living on the cross. Let me show you. Psalm 22:7, the psalmist writes, this is like generations before Jesus' crucifixion. The psalmist writes, all who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. The crucifixion story, Matthew 27, tells us that those who passed by Jesus hurled insults at him, shaking their heads. Psalm 22, 16 and 18, the psalmist writes, they pierce my hands and my feet. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. And you know that when Jesus is crucified, crucifixion is the piercing of hands and feet. And what does the story say? When they crucified Jesus, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. As any good Jewish rabbi would have, Jesus had every psalm memorized. This is why he was able to recite in his moment of agony this psalm. He was able to pull it out. This is the psalm that is my reality right now. He had all of the psalms memorized. Now, in Jewish tradition, and remember, Jesus is a good Jewish rabbi, in Jewish tradition, When you recite one part of a psalm, that is a nod to the audience, to the entire psalm. It's as if I were to say, A, B, C, D. Okay. Some of you are like, oh, I don't. What comes after D? Is it D, F? We would know it. And his audience would know it. As Jesus feels the abandonment and the isolation and loneliness of the tearing apart of his identity, he cries out the opening lines of a psalm that he knows is representative of his lived experience. But he also cries out this psalm because he knows that abandonment is not the end of the story. Though he feels abandoned now, forsaken now, forgotten now, abandonment is not the end. Because when you draw near the end of Psalm 22, what does the psalmist say? He has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. So let me ask the question again. Have you felt abandoned and alone? Do you know the bitter sting of isolation and loneliness, the feeling of being forsaken or forgotten? Again, most of us in this room do. What this story in Matthew's gospel, the scene of Jesus' death on the cross, what it tells us is that your feeling of abandonment and aloneness and isolation, the feeling of being forsaken and forgotten is real. And Jesus understands. He doesn't try to like sweep it under the rug. It is okay to feel the way you feel. I have felt that many times in my life. And at the same time, that abandonment is not the end of your story. God has not forgotten you, even though you feel forgotten. God has not forsaken you, even though you feel forsaken. God has not left you on your own to fend for yourself, even though so much of life feels that way. He sees you. He hears your cry for help. Then help is on the way. Help is on the way for you. And what the story will reveal to us in a moment is that help is on the way for the entire world. Not just for you, but for every person you know who feels abandoned and alone, forsaken and forgotten. And what the story will reveal to us in a moment is not only that help is on the way, but that help is already here. Verses 50 and 51, Jesus dies. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. That means that he dies. He breathes his last breath. And at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, long story short, the temple at the time, that was the place where God's people went to meet with God. The reason for this was because in a broken, fallen world, God cannot simply be everywhere at all times with all of us, because holiness and sin, holiness and brokenness cannot coexist. And so the people of God had built this beautiful, ornate temple, and within that temple was a center. The center of the temple was a place that they called the Holy of Holies. And literally, at the time of Jesus, God's people believed that God's presence was in the Holy of Holies. And so there was this really thick curtain, a couple of feet thick, actually, a curtain that you could not tear with your own hands. And this curtain separated the rest of the planet with this one point in this one geographic location on the planet where the people of God believed that God in all of his holiness and goodness would come down. The Holy of Holies is the intersection of heaven and earth, of God's space and human space. When Jesus dies, the curtain that separated God's space, God's presence from the rest of the world, that curtain rips in two. What that means is that now God's presence by his Spirit, because of Jesus' death, it spills out to all the earth. Now it means, if you read later in the New Testament, that there is no physical temple where you have to go to meet with God. What the New Testament writers will tell us is that God's people, you and me, those of us who have said yes to Jesus, we are the temple. You know, we see glimpses of this possibility, actually, way early in the story. There's this wild story in the first book of the Bible called Genesis, chapter 28. There's a young man named Jacob, and he's made a mess of his life. Let me read you a part of his story. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and he lay down to sleep. So Jacob goes to sleep. And then he has this wild dream, and here's what happens. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, because he had this vision, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and he said, how awesome is this place? There is none other. This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. This story takes place not in a temple or a tabernacle. This story takes place not because Jacob built some epic fire and sang some like shaman song and like evoked the spirits. He's literally like on a journey. He gets really tired. The sun sets and he goes to sleep. And in the dream, I didn't read it for you, it's long, but in a dream he has, God meets him there. And he wakes up and he says this incredible line, surely the Lord is in this place. And I was just not aware of it. Our friend Tim Mackey at the Bible Project, he describes this story this way. He says, Jacob didn't go to a place he knew was sacred, which made his encounter with God possible. It's the opposite. It's Jacob's encounter with God that makes the place sacred. No matter how alone you feel, how isolated you may feel, everywhere and anywhere you go, it is possible that that place is the intersection of heaven and earth. Because God is not confined to a geographic location anymore. The curtain has been torn, and his Spirit is everywhere and anywhere, and it is available. You don't have to go to sacred places to meet with God. You don't have to show up at Westgate Church where they have the music and the preacher to meet with God. Any place you go where you deepen your awareness and heighten your longing for his presence, that place is sacred because God is in that place, wherever that place may be. This is why the writer of Hebrews in chapter 10 says, therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body torn and the curtain torn. And since we have a great high priest, that's Jesus, over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and with the full assurance that faith brings. I'm going to invite Chris and the team to come back up. We're going to sing and respond together. No matter how abandoned or alone or isolated you feel, you are never alone. Every place you go, every moment you experience in this life holds latent within that moment and experience the possibility of encountering God. He is closer to you than you might possibly think or imagine. I have a friend named James who many years ago, he went on a mission trip to Nepal. And Nepal, like many countries in that part of the world, they have these temples, these pagan temples, and they have these prayer wheels. Has anybody ever seen these prayer wheels? Prayer wheels are there. It's a pagan practice where people will go to these pagan temples and they will literally spin these wheels. And they spin the wheel because they have this belief that they are spinning away the bad karma from their lives, and they are spinning toward themselves the good karma from the gods. And the entirety of their reality is built on how much, how intensely, how often, how consistently they can spin the wheels. That's their belief. That it is up to them. That if they don't go to the temple and spin, if they do not keep that wheel spinning, then the gods will not bless them. And my friend, James, he was telling me this. He was showing me some photos and some videos and just telling me about this experience afterwards with tears in his eyes. And he told me over and over again, with tears in his eyes, he said, all I wanted to do was go to every man, woman, and child with agony on their faces, spinning in desperation in hopes that the gods might actually bless them. I just wanted to go and shake every single one of them awake to the reality that you don't need to spin these wheels. God is already here. Like, that's all I wanted to say. You don't have to keep spinning these wheels. God is already here. He is already for you. He is already with you. You don't have to keep spinning your wheels. The curtain has ripped in two. The Spirit of God is as close as your very next breath. That situation at work or that relational tension, you don't have to keep spinning the wheels. It is sacred there in the midst of your brokenness, your sense of abandonment or forgottenness or forsakenness, in the middle of your depression or your anxiety or your uncertainty or your guilt or your shame. You do not need to keep spinning wheels. God is with you. God is for you. He has so much love toward you. You can't even fathom. God became totally abandoned so that you would know you are never abandoned. Jesus went to the cross completely alone so that you would know you are never alone. Jesus was forsaken and forgotten so that you would know that you don't have to spin any wheels. You are never forsaken. You are never forgotten. And every moment, every experience, every opportunity, every place, every situation of your life is sacred because God is here and He is for you. And there's nothing you can do to stop that reality from coming after you and capturing you. And if that's true for you, it's true for every person in your life who feels abandoned and alone. Think about not just the wheels you are spinning, but the wheels that your friends and family and coworkers and classmates and neighbors are spinning today. Here we are, hopefully a bit inspired, a bit lifted up and encouraged. But think about the hundreds and thousands of people and acquaintances this room represents right now, and they are out there spinning their wheels. Don't you want to go to them and say, you don't have to spin these wheels anymore? God sees you. He loves you. He's for you. He's with you. I want to give you a moment to think about a friend or a family member, someone in your life, or maybe a few people in your life. I want to give you a moment right now before the band leads us to just think about them. Like, imagine them. Imagine them spinning their wheels, the wheel of career or success or money or pleasure or whatever else. Imagine them spinning their wheels, hoping that it will bring enough good karma so that they might experience life and life to the full. And imagine how futile that is. this place of their pain, doubt, anxiety, uncertainty, their need, their desperation. I want you to imagine them, and I just want you to take 30 seconds and pray for them. That the Spirit of God right now, in a transcendent way, might somehow, some way, whisper to them, literally right now, you don't have to spin the wheels. And then I want you to pray for courage in your own heart and mind. If the opportunity comes up, to invite them. An easy invite is to Easter this coming weekend. But more than attending a service, for your life to invite them to the possibility of a God who breaks the wheel and says, I'm already with you. And I want you to pray that their hearts and minds might be open to that invitation. So take a moment, pray for them, and then Chris and the team will lead us.